Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We're in the middle of a mass protest movement, the likes of which we probably haven't seen since the 1960s. So an important question, if basic one, is essentially, do protests work? And more specifically, are these protests working? We spend a lot of time covering elections on this podcast, and when it comes to those kinds of campaigns, you get a straightforward answer at the end. You either won the election or you didn't. But judging the efficacy of a protest movement is a bit more complex. And so today, we'll try to lay out a rubric for assessing that question and see how the current protests are measuring up so far. And here with me to do that is 538 contributor Shom Mazumdar. He is a fellow at Data for Progress and has done research focusing on protest movements. He also wrote a piece for our website this week called What Protests Can and Can't Do. Hi, Shom.
Hey, good to be with you.
Also here with us is Mara Gay. She covers politics and New York with the New York Times editorial board and recently wrote about how the protests are leading to policy changes in New York and elsewhere. Thank you for joining us, Mara.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to dig into the details, but at first blush, Mara, are the current protests working?
I think it's pretty clear that policymakers are paying attention, that the protests have had an enormous effect already. Here in New York, we just repealed 50A, which was a police secrecy law that prevented records, disciplinary records, from being released to the public, not just for police officers, but also for correction officers and other key employees. You have the Minneapolis Police Department that has been disbanded and will be rebuilt to hopefully be more democratic and serve those it actually represents. And so I think, I would argue that it's quite clear that these protests are working, and voting is one part of the democratic process, but it's not the only part.
Shom, you've put together a rubric for judging whether or not protests are working. And Mara, you mentioned policy. It's clear that, you know, lawmakers are working on it and some of it has already changed. How else do you judge a protest movement?
I would say a big issue is just, did it raise awareness of the issue? I mean, it's clear that if we go back to, you know, the events of 2014, 2015 around Ferguson, it came as a huge shock to a lot of, especially white folks, that police violence and brutality were a day-to-day experience of African-Americans and people of color. And I think you're seeing that play out again, and not only raising awareness, but raising awareness of a particular dimension of police brutality, that the world that black people and people of color face is just very different, and the type of policing that they face is incredibly different.
I mean, I would just add that the other measure of looking at this, and you can take a look at public opinion polls around race and racism right now on these subjects and on the protests, but there's a cultural side to this equation. What's really interesting to me is that the police departments across the country have responded to largely peaceful protests with an extraordinary amount of violence, not in every case, but in many cases. And we are seeing now in public polling, public opinion polls, that a majority of Americans, including white Americans for the first time, are seeing this, are horrified, and their sympathies are actually not with these police departments. They're with the protesters. And that is an extraordinary amount of power that Black Lives Matter has amassed, and I think we're going to see it in the election.
Yeah, and this is something, Shom, your reporting gets at, which is like awareness is the first thing, then public opinion change is the next. Policy or institutional changes potentially follow, and then final are electoral consequences. And so you mentioned awareness, and Mar, you mentioned the changes in public opinion. Is what we're seeing right now unique as far as protest movements go in terms of the efficacy of it, how much awareness has been raised, and how swiftly public opinion has changed?
I think the main part is that's been really surprising to me, actually, just how rapidly public opinion has changed on this issue. If you think of like a lot of other movements or protests or, you know, social movements that have been out there around either inequality or climate, you haven't seen as much of a rapid change in the way you've seen attitudes around policing and race over just like the course of these past two and a half weeks, where now a majority of Americans view this as an issue. They tend to sympathize, as Mara was saying, with the protesters. So I think the just how fast things have changed makes this so much different, I think, in a lot of ways than things we've seen in the past, too.
You know, I would say that the closest parallel is, of course, the civil rights movement and the democratization of southern states in the 60s and 70s, and also the anti-war demonstrators who were met by violence from police, like at Kent State. I mean, to me, that's the closest parallel because you have a movement that has pushed for change for a very long time. I think Black Americans in particular feel like, actually, this isn't happening overnight. This is a movement that's taken decades to build. And finally, public support is turning, I agree, Shyam, very quickly. And in part because of the extremely violent response that these demonstrations have been met with. I mean, we are seeing white Americans being beaten in the streets on camera in broad daylight. You know, it shouldn't take that, obviously, but it's really hard to ignore. There's a lot of power in that.
I think that's an important dynamic to think about. This particular movement in this moment was started in many ways by the video of George Floyd. You know, maybe it's not possible to disentangle, but is this public opinion shift a direct response to that video? Is it a direct response to these protests? Or is it, as you're saying, Mara, something that is largely connected to white people seeing white protesters also being used violence against by the police? We saw the 75-year-old protester in Buffalo. I think everybody saw that video of him being pushed over and kind of bleeding from his head and ears. How are you processing what is so different about this moment?
I mean, I think, again, things are coming to a head now for several reasons. One of them is the George Floyd video. The other, of course, is the elephant in the room, which is Donald Trump, who's an outright white supremacist, and a majority of Americans do not share his views. The other is the coronavirus pandemic, which has been just taken a horrible toll on cities across the country and the people who live in them. And also lots of people are jobless. So I think you have essentially a perfect storm of events that has led all of this to come to a head. You also have this video in the George Floyd killing that is just, it cannot be defended. And it has not been defended by police. So I think all of that has come together to give voice and power to a movement that has actually been going on for the better part of 15 years.
And I know you've done some analysis here, Shyam, trying to put numbers to both awareness and public opinion. I'll say also Drumil Mehta, a database journalist here at 538, published a piece on the website this morning looking at media coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement, essentially finding that it waned a lot during the Trump administration. You know, back in 2014, 2015, there was significant coverage, and then media coverage tanked significantly since 2016. You've also looked at Google Trends and things like that to try to put numbers to what we're seeing and what's kind of self-evident. What'd you find?
I mean, so you see a big uptick in key demands of protesters around, you know, abolishing the police, defunding the police, and just, you know, searches around racism. I mean, so one thing that I found kind of interesting is this people looking inward, like, am I racist? And I think one thing, I mean, now this is kind of moving away from the data itself, but maybe a little bit more anecdotal, is just thinking about the ways in which protesters are forcing those on the sidelines to interrogate their own privilege and use their platforms or privilege and power that they do have to highlight the injustices that we're seeing vividly now, but have been going on for, you know, decades, and if you're thinking really kind of long-term centuries. But I think this opinion change and awareness change, to me, a thing that I would be, you know, I'd be looking out for is just there's so much going on under the Trump presidency where a headline pops up. There's multiple headlines every week. The thing that I would be, you know, looking out for is this going to get crowded out by the next thing that comes up? I mean, it doesn't seem like this opinion change is really waning, or the awareness of the issue is, or the intensity of the demands are waning in this moment. But I think it is important to, you know, think about, you know, a month out, 2 months out from now, is this still going to demand the attention of the American people?
One thing we see after, for example, mass shootings is public opinion very rapidly moves in the direction of increased restrictions on gun ownership, et cetera. And very much people will tell pollsters that they're now prioritizing it, for example. But then, very predictively, that peters out. And policy change, in large part, doesn't generally happen. You know, what parallels do you see here so far, or things that make it quite different? I mean, is there a reason to expect this to be more effective than protests surrounding mass shootings or gun ownership?
Again, I think there's a certain alchemy and magic to why it is that certain cultural movements catch on when they do. I don't have all the answers to that. But I do believe that as someone who's, I've been out there, the protesters have literally gone by my house several times. I've been out there with them a bit here in Brooklyn and Manhattan. And it feels different. And it's hard to quantify that. It feels like not just about police brutality, although that's at the heart of it. To me, it feels like a pro-democracy movement being led by Black people and by others who are fed up, but are not only angry, they want a better future, and they are extremely passionate. And I just think there's so much power in it. And the fact, again, that, you know, to me, it was striking. I've written about 50A, that police secrecy law, for years at this point. And it's the kind of thing your friends who read your work but aren't in politics will say, 50 what? You know, it's hard to get people to pay attention to. And then all of a sudden, in the past week or so, I've seen signs in the windows of doctors' offices, of Montessoris, on the side of cars in, you know, outside of New York City and Long Island that say repeal 50A, repeal 50A. So it feels like a huge cultural movement as well. And that's really hard to stop. And I just want to say as well that one thing that's really interesting is it's reached beyond the traditional Democratic base. I have several family friends who are Trump supporters who live in rural California and are evangelical white voters. And their pastor has started talking to them about racism and racism in America and in policing.
I totally agree with what you're saying. And if I could only add one thing, I think one reason why this moment really feels so much different than the moments around, you know, gun violence and school shootings is that, you know, if we think about, like, there's been, like, this groundwork has been laid for decades now. Like, if you think about the long, you know, history and tradition of Black organizing as a pro-democracy movement, like, that's been happening for ages now. So in some ways, it's like, yeah, there is this kind of, like, we can't quite put a word on what this moment is now and how it feels very different. But part of that is, I think it's because that groundwork has been laid, the work has been done for so long to organize around these issues, whether it's, you know, explicitly through, you know, the NAACP's work throughout, you know, Jim Crow and into the civil rights era. And now as we see kind of, you know, BLM as this diffuse organization, but I would say, you know, the organizers have done a lot of the work.
And so, Mara, you mentioned 50A. I think that a lot of people are going to look back and judge the movement in large part by legislation that's passed, right? The awareness, the public opinion, it's all part of the equation. But when we look back at the 60s, the narrative is in large part around the civil rights laws that were eventually passed. And so what other kinds of legislation are we seeing or policy changes are we seeing as a result of this moment?
Yeah, so I just want to say it's certainly early days still. And policing actually in particular is a very local issue. So it is already playing out. California is about to ban chokeholds. Again, you see police departments like Minneapolis and Atlanta seeing changes. But also the discussion around qualified immunity for police officers at the national level is starting to happen. So we'll see what happens with the reconciliation between the Democratic and Republican policing bills on Capitol Hill. But also, I think it's going to be a movement that's not just about policing. I really believe this is a pro-democracy movement and that Donald Trump, assuming he loses in November, that what you're going to see in the coming years is a whole host of legislation around health and racial justice and education, things that we really haven't seen wholesale movement on since the 60s. Some of the landmark legislation, like the 1964-65 Civil Rights Act, Fair Housing Law. This is really, I think, a continuation of that work that has been done.
Are there, Shoham, this is something you've studied, so are there protest movements that don't work? Or does every protest movement at least, you know, raise awareness? Are there times that we can look and say, no, that really didn't work?
I mean, you hinted at, you know, the movement against gun violence in schools. You know, if you think about reinstating the assault weapons ban, there are clear policies that have been demanded that just haven't, you know, even been considered at this point. So I think in that sense, it's like there's not a one-to-one mapping between, you know, just because you have a protest or a social movement that you're somehow, it's going to instantly create change. If I were to say, I mean, the thing about, at least some of the work I've seen, at least in terms of, you know, movement organizing, is like, how do you activate people's identities as well? So if you're thinking about, you know, what makes this different than something like, you know, the climate movement or something like, you know, the movement against gun violence, is that I think there's a clear appeal in this situation to just a core identity is like, you know, Americans deserve, you know, equal treatment under the law. And then now it's like so clear that that's not the case at all. And so I think there's a huge component of just, if you're trying to build, you know, a cross coalition movement, which I think you are seeing happening right now, like even like, you know, going back to the qualified immunity example, you know, with Justin Amash co-sponsoring that legislation, that's, to me, it feels like this is tapping into something, you know, a core belief about what it means to be an American and the, you know, deserving equal respect, equal opportunity, equal treatment under the law. And it's so stark here that it isn't the case, that if you want to live up to that, like if that's what it means to be an American, then we clearly failed that. And so, you know, yeah, that goes back into some of that. The idea is that Mara's talking about this being a pro-democracy movement in that sense as well, or a pro-American movement.
The final metric that you use to judge whether or not protests are working are their electoral consequences in the rubric that you wrote about for us at 538. You know, it's too soon to talk about its effect on the 2020 election's result. We can look at polls and things like that so far. But do you see it changing the contours of either the general election or even primary elections?
Starting with the general election, it's clear now that policing is going to have to be a central issue in this 2020 election. Or at least I think voters on the Democratic side are going to demand that this is a central issue. And so it seems to me that in a broad respect, like this is just changing what the agenda is going to be for when we think about how to evaluate who you want to vote for in 2020. This seems to be that's going to be a key issue that's going to characterize candidates. What I've noticed is that, you know, just now as you have primaries going on, like this is the issue, especially in cities where, you know, police are an incredible presence, even in, you know, Democratic or progressive leaning cities, that the issue of police is going to have to be something that candidates are going to have to be able to say something about. And so in that respect, like, I think that is an electoral consequence to me, above and beyond like who wins and who loses the election. It's forced on the electoral agenda.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the questions that I have is what this will do, if anything, what these demonstrations will do to turnout in primary elections. And it's very often the case in American politics and American history that if you can get someone to a protest, you can definitely get them to vote. It's not always one-to-one, to Shoham's point, but it's often the case. And so Sometimes I think, in fact, it's what differentiates a movement from a flash in the pan. Like, frankly, and I mean no disrespect to him, but Senator Bernie Sanders, he was able to draw large crowds, but not as many votes. Whereas here, I think there's an opportunity, especially with folks engaged in such hyper-local issues like 50A or like the Minneapolis Police Department. I think we might see more people at the polls.
Yeah, and I would say some of the evidence also go in line with that. So Dan Gillian, who's a political scientist at University of Pennsylvania, just had a new book come out on this issue of protests and social movements. And he shows that a lot of social movements, especially around race and minority-led movements, do, engage citizens above and beyond just showing up to protests. They get them to turn out when candidates can deliver on their promises and messages. And you've seen that also with the Tea Party movement too, which I think is like, we've been focused a lot on the BLM movement right now and the movement against, police brutality. But you saw the Tea Party was quite sophisticated in its way to engage voters, turn its initial, set of protests into a huge organizational infrastructure. So Theda Scotchpole has a great book that's out on that.
Looking down the pike, what measurements would you use to judge whether or not this is successful, considering that there's only 2.5 weeks, to this movement so far?
I mean, so Mara's already talked about, the repeal of 58. Like, usually it's so hard to get people interested in local politics, because voter turnout is usually pretty low in these elections. A lot of it is like you have to follow closely city council meetings. Political party labels often don't really, tell you a whole lot about what the candidates actually stand for. And just seeing the organizing around local politics that's been happening, and that's very different than what I've seen in a lot of other issues, which tend to focus on, national issues, which are harder to do in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I would also just say, just to emphasize some points and add a few more, voter turnout in the primaries and locally and in the general election, the number of new candidates who are elected and sent to Congress, so the flipping of seats, certainly state, local, and federal legislation around policing and racism, the toppling of Confederate monuments, statues, names, the corporate movement that we've seen, even from NASCAR, to remove Confederate symbols and other racist, traitorous, frankly, symbols from our national cultural sphere, the open discussion among conservatives and evangelicals and other religious groups about racism and race in America. And finally, I think, a cleaning house and a rebuilding of police departments and the remaking of police departments across the country to, again, full circle here, serve the people who pay them in taxpayer dollars, and also to hold accountable officers for misconduct. Those are just some of the metrics. But I think ultimately another metric, and I'll just offer this, on my own personal front, is thinking about, we're talking about the 60s and the 70s. I am a Black American. My mom is white. My dad is Black. I was born in 1986. My experience growing up in this country, I experienced far more freedom and equality than my father did. My father, who is still alive, very healthy, drank out of a segregated water fountain, went to segregated schools, was subject to state terrorism at the hands of police, and so was not really a full citizen of the United States. So I think I'm just trying to give a little bit of a sense of, let's broaden the way that we talk about success and metrics of success, and also the, our perspective on the length of time that democratization has taken. We've really only been a democracy in this country fully since the 1970s.
I mean, it's an interesting point that you make, because in judging whether or not a protest movement is successful, you might have looked at the Black Lives Matter protest movement in 2015 and 2016 and say, well, it wasn't really successful. But I guess part of the message here is, looking at this current protest movement that we've categorized as successful as encompassing other decades, other protests in the past.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, I think you've laid out some interesting metrics for us to keep watching for and judge the efficacy of this protest movement based on. But I think we can leave it there. So thank you so much, Mara and Shom. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys. Great to see you. Yep.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.